This week on the Dragzine Podcast, we talk to Pro Mod racing legend Bill Coleman and take a stroll down memory lane as he recounts everything of the big stories that happened during his career. So, pull those belts tight. Get ready to put in the beans. The Dragzine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. And this week, we get to talk with someone that's probably one of the biggest people who drove pro mod racing where it is, Bill Coleman, and get to hear some really cool stories about what it was like to be the first person to go 200 miles an hour and kind of the origins and history behind pro mod racing. So, you know, without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is probably what some might consider the grandfather, the great-grandfather of pro mod racing, Mr. Bill Coleman. What's up, Bill?
How you doing, Brian?
Doing good, doing good. Thank you for coming on the show. It's an honor to have someone that's done so much in the sport of drag racing, especially in the area of pro mod like you on the show, especially now with just how absolutely scorching hot the class has become these days.
Sure. Thank you.
Oh, no problem, no problem. You know, it's what I find funny, I was going back through and reading up on you quite a bit, and looking through your accomplishments, it's almost crazy to think that there's a lot of people these days that might not fully grasp what you did because it wasn't in this modern digital age. But at the same time, I mean, some of these, you know, records and what you did were just absolutely insane. And I think these days, if you were doing it, it would be just completely all over the place. Sort of like with, you know, the radial tire racers are experiencing these days. And the first thing I wanted to touch on, you know, from your experience being around it so much, what's, you know, the biggest thing you see difference-wise between when you first started racing pro mod and to what they're doing now?
The biggest thing right now is everybody's buying and paying for their performance. It's established. The cars are so much easier to drive, even though they do have more power, because 99% of them are using torque converters, just smashing the pedal and going. That, and the torque converter is a nice, smooth transition all the way through the run, where in my day, it was a four-speed Lenco, and then when we went with the blown combinations, it was a three-speed and eventually worked to a two-speed. But it made for a violent, violent car because of clutch applications. A lot of guys in racing think that a drag racer just goes up there and lets out on the clutch. But when you run a high-powered combination where you're going to have nitrous hit at the throttle, or you're going to, especially the blown, where you have to basically load the clutch, it's a different world. So you got to have all that stuff right, and it only comes from trial and error. So the basic difference is, one, it's five times as expensive, and two, you can buy everything you need out there. And in Tim McAmis's video, I'm not a big Tim fan, but I did love this one video. He sold a beginner's pro mod kit. It consisted of a button and a 16-ounce soda and a bag of Cheetos, where you just let go of the button, and while you're going down the track, you can drink your drink and eat your Cheetos. So a lot easier to do, a lot more money right now.
Oh, yeah. I think those are two extremely valid points. You know, the money one being number one, you know, first is just, it's mind numbing when you're on the, you know, when you are in the industry and you know what this stuff costs and how much cubic dollars are just being thrown at these cars is unreal. And then, you know, to the point of them being easier to drive, you know, back when, you know, when this all first started, you guys were literally, you know, inventing the wheel with these cars. So there was no set combination for you guys, really.
Yeah, the cars themselves, chassis-wise, haven't changed hardly at all. Hardly at all. Except the components that the guys are running. You know, they're running adjustable shocks for any variance in the surface. They're running programmed, basically traction control. traction control on most of the cars. In a lot of them, the guys don't even have to pull their own parachute.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more automation, and you know, the earlier really fast door cars were just, they were angry animals on nitrous, and then you throw a blower in there and they were just, you know, they were all over the place.
Yeah, I've always said that the early Pro Mods were the, and I'll tell you what, a couple of some of the biggest names in drag racing would come up and say the same thing. They were the hardest cars to drive in racing, in any kind of racing, because of the power to weight ratio. Everybody thinks, how hard would it be taking a car and going straight down a track for a quarter mile or an eighth mile? Well, the question is, why are so many crashing? Well, they're not that easy just to drive in a straight road. The back end's trying to eat up the front end.
Oh, yeah, they're all over the place, and you're basically in a 5,000-horsepower car that's trying to kill you at every step of the way.
Pretty much.
And I think, you know, you can make a direct correlation between, you know, even Pro Mods to this day are still, can be a little bit tricky to drive, but, you know, originally they were like the old-school fuel altered, you know. You knew when that tree dropped, something was going to happen, and you were kind of on the edge of your seat to see what it was.
Right. I always, I look back at the fuel alters and sometimes I question, and I'm comparing it to Pro Mods in the era that I drove. I sometimes question why they didn't even go quicker than they did. But then again, a fuel altered was usually a handmade deal. No chassis builder says I specialize in fuel alters. Everything was different, and guys tried different combinations, and they were fun to watch, and you didn't know what they were going to do. But I'm a little surprised they didn't go faster than they did. But then again, the era, it was a different era. Power levels change.
Oh, yeah. The power levels, you know, it, like you said, people make a whole lot more power now, but they're still, you know, they're still kind of tied to the laws of physics, and being able to manage that power and get it down is, you know, isn't the easiest task on earth.
You know, as I, when I was at, well, I've had a lot of highlights and heydays, but one of my highlight of, or heydays as you call it, was in 2000. I was the fastest guy in the world for, you know, years. And then as I kicked the power level up and started running some nitro, I had what everybody said was, damn, that car is an uncontrollable car. No, it really wasn't. The power level was up. And then people start saying, well, I don't know if he can drive anymore. He's banging walls. He's doing this. He's doing that. Well, it wasn't long after that, guys started using Whipple chargers and other things like that, and their power level went up, and then they started banging walls and putting them on the roof. And so they finally got to see what I was dealing with back then.
Oh, yeah. Those nitro coupes, those things were animals. That was always a fun to go watch those things, because it was literally like, you know, we went to one of the events with my dad, and he said, you know, this is just like the old school stuff where you watched every second of it because you didn't want to miss what might or might not happen. It might be a really close race, or someone might be crossing the 8th mile mark on their lid.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like that. And isn't it funny how drag racing has so many safety rules. And sometimes you can go to, especially an NHRA event at times, and watch some pro classes that are kind of boring, but when NHRA advertises, all they want to show is the crashes and the wrecks.
Oh, yeah. They want to be able to get people in and sell that excitement, but yeah, it's, you know, the safety's paramount, and people, it's, you know, it's like the reason why people watch NASCAR. There's some people that just watch it for the crashes and they get mad when it doesn't happen, but
yeah, they call that boring.
Yeah. They want to see insanity. Go to a dirt track race. I try to explain to people, you want to, dirt late models are basically roller derby with a roll cage is the best way to describe what that is. And it's, you know,
wild
for sure. And, you know, kind of touching on what you've done with records, being the, you know, all these years now, you know, you're the first guy to go 200 miles an hour in a door slammer. That's something that is just, to me, an amazing feat considering the time and the technology. And really, you know, people aren't going a whole lot more faster than that these days. You know, what was it really like trying to figure out the technology to go that, be the first person to go that fast?
Well, it was interesting. I didn't have my mind on that at the time. I was running UDRA Pro Stock, and I was the first guy that showed up at a UDRA race with a big wing and nitrous on the car. And the rules makers immediately just jumped all over me. You can't run nitrous in Pro Stock. And I already had my answer for him. I said, show me. It was so, how should I say it? It was so accepted, so known, that Pro Stock was carburetors and gasoline, that they didn't even print in the rule book no other power adders. And my deal at that race was, show me in the rule book where it says I can't, and they couldn't show me. So naturally, they had to let me go. So I ended up being quite a bit faster with an old single nitrous kit. But over that winter, back then there was no internet, there was no media like we have today. It was Hot Rod and Super Stock and Car Craft. It was magazines and some drag racing papers. And that whole winter of 86, all they were talking about, who's going to be the first door car to go 200, to call it the last big barrier in drag racing and on down the line. And it was always mentioned that, is it going to be Bob Glidden, Warren Johnson, Buddy Ingersoll, or there's this guy out in the Midwest that goes awful fast on bad tracks, so I was called the underdog, Bill Kuhlman. And that was the first time I thought even about attempting. So I sat down with my son. I was divorced at the time, so it's just me and him sitting at home. And I had this car, and it was super lightweight, and it was a legal UDRA Pro Stock. And I said, let's take a shot at this 200. They say we're in the running. Let's take a shot at it. So we sat down and decided we're going to need even a bigger wing. We're going to have to get a different nitrous system, because I was running CompuCar at the time. And I called Mike Thermos out of NOS and told him what I wanted to do. And I also thought, we need a better engine. I was running a Rearin Morrison 615 Pro Stock motor. And I had a sponsor at the time, John Taylor. He's just a local friend that ran a salvage yard in St. Louis. And originally the way I got together, with Taylor was he built a Pro Stocker nobody could drive. And I, for a short period of time, was the first employee that Jerry Bickle ever had. So I was working at Bickle's, and they brought that car in there, and they said it was just undrivable. And so Bickle told me, go through it, line it up. And then Taylor had tried everybody in St. Louis to drive it. And finally, he said, and Bickle says, why don't you let Bill drive it? So I went out with him and Bob Murray, an old Top Fuel racer, and we ran into track, and it was nothing, just back and forth, up and down the track. So I started driving for Taylor, and Taylor kept me going in his car. And then finally, when I was going to do this 200-mile-an-hour thing, I said to him, John, I need a better motor, but we can't afford to buy one. You know, nobody builds a nitrous motor, but this guy named Sonny Leonard built some big cubic inch stuff down in Virginia. And I see in these books and magazines, he has a kit motor for sale. So what if we buy the kit motor? So John bought me the kit. I built the motor. And then we showed up at Darlington as the dark horse. And 10 o'clock on Saturday night, everybody saw 202 mile an hour.
That's insane. So that
go ahead.
I was going to say, just, you know, how big was the motor that you ran in that car at that time?
615-inch. Big block, a chevy block, a bow tie block. It had dart heads, Sonny Leonard aluminum fabricated manifold, two dominators, just a standard big Pro Stock motor of Sonny's. And 615 was as big as anybody was making them at the time. And then I put an NOS single fogger, I mean a stock fogger kit on it. And my first run down the red, and here's a kind of a, if you want a humorous story. My first run down the track on Friday, first of all, IHRA, I was this Yankee from the north down there with their southern boys, and I had called Ted Jones, who owned NHRA, thinking he would be up on all the books and magazines. And I said, Ted, my name is Bill Coleman. I'm one of the guys that they're talking about can possibly run 200. I want to come down to Darlington at your first national event and try for that. I can run it in top sportsman and be legal. I said, I only asked two things. And he says, what's that? And I said, can I get in free and can you park me on asphalt? He said, sure. So I go down there. He was nowhere to be found, so I had to pay for my way in. I got parked in a dirt hole. And the very first thing that happened was cars would be coming down the return road, but there was a big dip in the asphalt return road right where I was pitted. So they'd swerve off the road, drive through the back of my pit, just showering my car with dust. So, and I about got laughed out of the place with the big wing and things like that, you know. So anyway, long story short, I put some orange cones out there to keep them on the road. And this guy comes by and he kicked all my cones into my pit. It's some official, he had an official shirt on. So I put him back out there and he came by and he kicked them again. He had that striped shirt. He had a cowboy hat on. And this went back and forth for 3 or 4 times. Finally, I had had enough, and he came through there, and I went out there and met him. He says, you going to get these cones off of this thing? I said, look, these people are driving through my pit. They're throwing dirt all over my engine and everything else. He says, I'm telling you, you getting these cones out of here? And I said, are you telling or are you asking? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I could tell you I don't like your cowboy hat, and I could knock it off your head, or I could ask you to take it off. And he looked at me kind of funny. He says, will you move those? I said, yeah, since you ask, I'll move them. So anyway, later, all the racers around me were all local guys, and they all knew who I was talking to. I had no idea. If they all came over and, do you know who that was? I said, hell no, there goes the language. Sorry, I'll back off on that. He says, that was Robert Leonard, head of tech for IHRA. So that I got off to a bad start with him. And then at any rate, like I say, that Friday night, or Friday night I made my first run, and in high gear the clutch went out. And the car coasted to 193 mile an hour. And I thought, oh my God, 200 would be easy if I keep a clutch in here. So I put in a clutch, and the next day, Sonny Leonard, who I had never met, come walking over, and he knew there was a 193 mile an hour car on the property, better than any of his IHRA pro stockers. He introduced himself, and basically, I said, Sonny, I just did 193 and the clutch blew out and high and this. And I said, 200 mile an hour is going to be a piece of cake. He looked at me funny. He turned around and just walked away. And he walked straight over to Bob Glidden. And it was within hearing distance. And I was just kind of watching him. I'd never met Sonny Leonard before. Never was on the same property with Bob Glidden before. A lot of big names for me, Warren Johnson and Glidden. And anyway, he says to Bob Glidden, do you see that stupid SOB over there? And Glidden looked at me and said, yeah. He says 200 mile an hour is going to be a piece of cake. And Glidden just shook his head. Well, the moral of the story is the next morning after I'd went 200 mile an hour, Sonny Leonard was adjusting my valves.
That's awesome. That
and we got to be great friends after that. And I made him a millionaire along with Mike Thurmos.
I'd say at that point, people are probably tripping over themselves to come get an engine from Sonny for sure.
Well, it's just funny. Mike Thurmos at NOS was the master of marketing, and he had me in every book and magazine known to man. And Sonny, same way, he had the first 200-mile-an-hour engine, and I watched them both go from these little bitty, tiny shop hole-in-the-wall things to these great big facilities with this and that. And I'm looking at him, thinking, "Holy cow! I wish it would have worked out the same for me."
Yeah, I'd say that's that having that ability to hang their moniker on that was probably, as you said, huge for them. And looking at that, you said it was a 615 cubic inch engine. You went 200 miles an hour. These guys now have almost 1,000 cubic inch engines, and they're going, what, barely 260 in a nitrous car with a whole lot more giggle juice being thrown at it.
Yeah.
And it's EFI, not carbureted. It's to me that just really kind of tells the tale with what you're able to do with, a fogger kit and, an engine compared to the spaceships that these guys are running now. Not to take anything away from them, but it's like, the Apollo mission, putting someone on the moon was the equivalent of what you're able to do with that technology.
Well, it was, and like today, from nitrous to double systems to triple system, I tested all that stuff. I've got photos of them, 55-gallon barrels full of burnt up pistons. If I hadn't have gotten the sponsorship from Summit after the 200-mile-an-hour deal, I wouldn't have had 55-gallon barrels of pistons because I wouldn't have been able to afford to buy them. But long story short, they gave me funds that I had never had. Not that much money. I mean, I'd be glad to tell you all about that and what it amounted to. But when you're racing out of your pocket and you're racing for a living and your budget for a year might be 50 grand, and you got to earn that and work on the side and build chassis and build cars for people. It's just like I told you, I was the first employee at Bicklehead. This was so long ago that when I knew Bickle wanted me, I sat down and told myself, now this is how long ago, as I said, I'm gonna work for cash. I'm going to work for my own hours, and I'm going to work for a minimum of $10 an hour. So that kind of gives you an idea. And then Bickle came in, and his first words was, "Well, first, you got to work for cash. Second, your hours are your own, and I'll give you $15 an hour." So everything was good for that short period of time I worked there.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that racing at a high level and the budgets that it takes, back then were, economy to scale. You look at inflation was, probably just as crazy at what it was now racing at that level. And, I think the partnership with Summit that you had, that was like first one of the really big mega deals for a pro mod racer, wasn't it?
Well, for what they called a sportsman car, it was the biggest deal. I went on display at Summit, and this was at their old facilities. Being the first 200-mile-an-hour car, I'm there on display, and I got on John Taylor's old black crew cab truck and a 25-foot heavy old metal enclosed trailer, just a box. And my girlfriend was with me at the time, and as we was leaving this display, she said, "If you guys ever think about sponsoring anybody, we could sure use the help." So later, a year later, I heard that there are agents out there that could get you deals for a percentage. So I ended up with John Asher, who, oh, I think John in his career was editor of Hot Rod and Superstock at one time. They all seemed to pass through the editorship of all the magazines. But anyway, Asher's deal was 15%. But what was crazy with Asher, well, who have you talked to? The only person I talked to was Summit. That's all Asher leaned on, just Summit, 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 Summit. And I was paying for renderings and this and that and on and on. And Summit said no. So finally, at Vegas at the PRI show, I said, you think I know Summit's here, that Paul Sergi, the owner, is here. I said to Asher, you think we could buy him breakfast and just tell him we accept the fact he's not going to sponsor me, but we'd like to talk to him to see if there's anything we did wrong or anything we could do to improve this presentation. So Paul graciously accepted our offer. We met at some motel restaurant, and Asher's yakking and yakking and yakking. I'm not saying anything, and Asher's going on and on and on and on and on. And Paul said, and finally Paul started talking to me, and I don't even recall the conversation. He just asked questions back and forth, and I just started talking to him. And he says, well, let me see those renderings again. He looked at them. He said, I wouldn't paint the car this color. I'd paint the car red, white, and blue. He said, that's the first thing I'd do, and blah, blah, blah. So anyhow, he stood up. He said, and this is in a crowded restaurant. He stood up and he said, well, I'm still not going to sponsor this car, just so you know. But after talking to him, I'm going to sponsor this guy. And he says, so get a hold of me. And I looked at Asher. He looked at me. We didn't say a word. And Sergi walked out of the restaurant. We both jumped up to the big Yahoo. And then Summit came on with their first deal. And their first deal. Now, this is a guy you got to realize. Nobody's given me anything. After I went 200, I got a lot of free parts. I got clutches and dampeners and different companies. Well, what I did was I was on an airplane flying home, and I made a list of every item on the car, and I had purchased every damn one of them. But I made a list of all the companies that were on that car. We're talking about master cylinder and wheels and brakes and tires and whatever it takes to build a car. And I wrote them all a thank you letter. I wrote them all a thank you for being part of my car, which was the first 200-mile-an-hour car history. Didn't ask for anything, just sent them a big thank you note. And by God, they started advertising. I was in every book and magazine there was, and all these guys started giving me free parts. So I had a free part list you wouldn't believe. So then Summit, they get together. He calls back. He says, I'm going to give you a 3-year contract, $100,000 a year, the first year, $115,000 the second year, and $140,000 the third year. And I thought, this is unbelievable. I'm getting all these free parts. I was racing out of my pocket. And now here's $100,000 minus Asher's 15%. So I raced the first year and everything went fine. And then we met at SEMA the second year and sat down with him again. And we had done great. Long story short, he says, I want to change the contract. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, man, what's going to happen here? He says, I only want to give you a $10,000 raise each year. And I immediately said to myself, Bill, who else gets a $10,000 raise a year in their job? Nobody gets a $10,000 raise back in those days. I said, so whatever he asks for, I've got to take. I have no choice. He says, but I want to put in an incentive bonus. And first of all, it hit me wrong. I'm thinking, if this guy don't know I'm busting my rear end to go as fast as I can every run down the track, I don't need incentive. But he said he want to give me an incentive bonus. So I said, well, what do you want to give me? And I don't remember whether it was $2,000 or $5,000. He says, if you, from right now, become the world's fastest car and hold the record, I'll give you $5,000 a week for every week that you hold it. And I'll pay you $5,000 for every win in any organization you're in. I'll pay you $2,500 for runner-up, and blah, blah, blah. Well, Asher didn't say nothing, but I said, fine, I'll do that. Asher had a fit. He said, I had you set up for $145,000, and here you accept this stupid incentive thing that may be impossible to hit. You'll never see it. And on down the line, and I was supposed to get 15% of $145,000. And I was so fed up with him, I said, John, I'm going to pay you your commission on the original contract. But if I hit any of these incentives, you don't get a penny of them. And I went out that first race, set the world record, and held it for a year and a half. So that's how that deal went down.
At any rate. That's just funny. And then I
got rid of Asher.
Get rid of the chattering animal that's costing you all the extra heartache, and just, you know, go do your own thing. That's some pretty funny stuff right there, and just that shows that, you know, you got to be very careful what kind of stake you hang in front of a racer, because a driven racer is a very fundamentally difficult person to defeat.
Yeah. Just what's funny is you take a racer that is a good racer, finishes in the top 10 in a professional class every year, and he's doing it out of his pocket. You can just about throw anything at him that's free, and he'll gobble it up because he's never gotten anything free before, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing about the 200,000 plus the 100,000 plus the incentives of 10,000 next year, 110, next year, 120. Finally, about 3 or 4 years in, I'm at a race on a Wednesday night, a match race, and it wasn't a match race. I think it was a USSC race at Norwalk. And being so close to Summit, I didn't know it, but Paul Sergi, the owner of Summit, was at the race, unbeknownst to me. So I qualify number one and this and that, and then we're going to race the next day. And Paul comes up to me, hey, how you doing? Glad to see you here, and this and that, and on and on. He says, congratulations on qualifying number one. He says, man, that Jim Oddie car, them people really love that blown car. I said, yeah, they're loud. They make a lot of noise. They're pretty popular. And he says, you know, we need one of those. And I said, yeah, I know, but I don't know a damn thing about them. And I'd be starting from scratch. And he says, well, he said, what do you think it costs? So he had me, I'm at a race trying to concentrate. What do you think it would cost to get a blown engine? Now my head's racing. I'm thinking, man, a different engine, zoomy headers, a different fuel tank, a different fire suit, a different fire bottle, a mag instead of a mag instead of an ignition, a different tack, and all this stuff, different weight bearing. And I'm just scrambling, and this is all within 2 seconds after he asked the question. I said, I don't know. I said, I bet at least $50,000. And he said, well, here's $50,000. Let's see one. It cost me $200,000.
Ouch.
So that's how I ended up getting into the blown alcohol stuff. I was just forced into it. At any rate, and I'm glad. Overall, I did, because I learned a whole new world, and it eventually led to a nitro coupe and this and that. People don't realize the story behind what happens, why guys do stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's funny when you get to on the media side of things. You know, I grew up being a drag racing fan. Now I get to be on the media side of things, and you get to see and hear a lot of stuff that people generally don't get to hear the whole story for. That's what's kind of cool about this podcast, is I can bring some of these stories out. And it's funny, I was going to ask you, how did you end up, you know, going from, you know, being the world's fastest man with a nitrous car, and all of a sudden, you know, driving a blower car? That kind of answered that question real quick.
Yeah, that was how it happened. But, you know, it's a progression in drag racing. As I say to many people when they ask the same question, I said, what was your first car? And they tell me what it was in the engine. I said, well, just answer me this. When you went to a four barrel from your first two barrel, did you ever go back to a two barrel? Heck no. When you went to four barrel to 2.4s, did you ever go back? No. 2.4s to fuel injection, you go back? No. Gasoline to alcohol, did you go back? No. And that's how it went. And same thing with blower to nitro. If you've got the ability to handle the car and you got the knowledge, I guess, to make it work. I'm just all self-taught. You don't want to slow down. You don't want to go back. I've had offers to drive all kinds of cars, and I just said, no, that'd be like stepping back in the 1970.
Yeah, it's funny seeing guys that, you know, these days that are multidiscipline racers, and it's, you know, I talked to Leah Pritchard about this, the difference between a top fueler and a factory stock car. And, you know, they're totally different animals. And, you know, the fuel car is just so, everything happens so quick. Everything happens, you know, quickly in a 7-second car, but it ain't the same at going 300. I imagine it's probably the same thing, you know, racing really fast door cars and asking, you know, for someone to have you step down a notch. It's not going to be the same for you at all.
No, it's not at all. I had yesterday, for example, I had to make a quick run. I'm a workaholic, and I was fabricating something for a guy. My chop saw motor blew up, and then my wife informed me that our dryer blew up. So I got on the internet, and I live way out in the sticks. And I'm thinking, man, the only place there's a harbor freight to get a chop saw is in Quincy, Illinois. That's an hour away. And she wants a dryer. I can get that in Hannibal, Missouri at Lowe's. So I said, I got to go. I looked on the internet to find out what time they closed, and I had like an hour and a half. And I'm driving a Ford F-150 pickup, and I'm out in the country. But I'm looking and looking and looking for cops, because I look down, it's 95, 100, 105, and it just seems slow as could be.
Oh, yeah, it's, you know, when you've been 200, anything less is just kind of, you know, well, I'm just going 100, that's all.
Especially if it's every weekend, week in, week out, you know.
A friend of mine that we raced with, a guy named Mark Carlisle, he had the IRS record for years in his car, and you know, he started out here locally racing, and, you know, he got progressively faster. And he told me one time, he said, the biggest difference I noticed wasn't necessarily sometimes how fast, you know, I was going. He said, I noticed the biggest difference when I had to slow down and I was running out of real estate.
Yeah, that's part of it. I never looked at that as something that stuck in my mind, the slowing down factor. I know I had a lot of different slowing down experiences. I think one of the biggest shockers in my life in racing in terms of the speed was two different cars. I went from a pro stock small block Monza, which was a competitive fast car, and I sold it, and I built a rear-engine dragster. I was just going to, if all they had around me were these bracket races, I was going to build a bracket car just like I built the 200-mile car. I was going to build a specific bracket car to start winning some of that money. And I won so much that they thought I was cheating. I wasn't. I just come up with a different way to do it. But the first time, two things in that car kind of surprised me. When I put my 350 small block Chevy in there and I'm in the seat and I tap the gas and the whole chassis rocked, I went, wow. And then the second thing is when I was going down the racetrack and all I could see is them two front wheels just dancing in front of me. Couldn't see anything else. That surprised me. But one other time when I first drove my first small block Vega Pro Stocker for another guy in my town that built one, the same deal. Nobody could drive it, so I drove it. And when you put it in high gear, it was pulling as hard as it did in low gear. That was a surprise. You know, you go, wow, I've never felt anything like that. So there's always something that'll surprise you, even if it's stopping, if it's parachutes, if it's running out of real estate. Nobody's the wild man they think they are. Something will always get their attention.
Yeah, mortality will for a human will always kick in at some point when something grabs your attention real quick. And
it's funny you mention that, because in the 73, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 era, when the pro stockers were Vegas and Monzas and Pinos and things like that, if you opened a national dragster, which back then was the Bible of drag racing, somebody got killed every single week in one of those cars. And I remember every time I strapped in, for example, my mom's a pro stalker, every single time I'd pull them belts tight and I'd say to myself, Bill, look around, take all of this in, because this may be the last thing you ever see. And I did that religiously. And I don't know where that came from, but I took it serious.
Oh yeah, it's crazy looking back at the, you know, almost like the cars were, you know, stone age in comparison, especially when I get on these kicks sometimes where I'll watch a lot of old nostalgia stuff, pro stock and, you know, fuel cars and whatnot. And it's utterly terrifying when you look at the chassis of those cars and how fast that they were going.
Well, what amazes me is the big names. Big, big names, your heroes. You never met them. You always read about them. My son puts out a page every day called Bill Kuma's Drag Racing Life. I don't put it out. He does. But he puts a different picture every day. And then he also sends me an email, which I pass on to about 30 people, and they pass them on the hundreds, of about 25 modern to early day drag photos. Just he's been doing this for so long, thousands and thousands of pictures. And I look at some of those cars that were the most high-tech vehicles in the world of their time, and I say to myself, what junk I'm looking at. What no talent craftsmanship. Why would he choose a body with a front end like a piece of 4x8 plywood, things like that? Oh. Yeah, things really have changed.
Oh, you know, you look at how fast, you know, when they were going, you know, and you know, a fuel car when they first, you know, broke over 200, and those cars were just, they were scary. They were really, really scary to look at, let alone I couldn't imagine being in something like that and how it would, you know, kind of handle, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's especially the rear engine where they're sitting on, basically sitting on the third member with just a stock casing and housing. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a wonder there aren't more double amputees out there with stuff like that.
Well, in UDRA, United Drag Race Association, when I ran it, a lot of the guys that ran that organization were ex-fuel drivers. And 90% of them had this limp, and we called it the UDRA limp. And it comes from accidents they had during their time when they were drivers.
Oh, I could imagine it. You know, back in those days, you see some of those. You know, I follow that Facebook page your son puts out, and I'll look at a lot of some of these. You'll see these old crash pictures online, and you see legs exposed, dangling, and these cars are tumbling down the tracks. It's like, holy smokes. That's just brutal to watch. And then you get people like, you know, Larry Dixon, who basically went into low orbit at 300 miles an hour. And, you know, I mean, it messed up his back a little bit, but, you know, it didn't kill him.
Yeah, it's amazing. In the early days, here in Missouri, we get a lot of tornado warnings. And I always told my kids, if you want to be safe, go drive yourself in the race car.
Yeah, literally, just get in the race car, put the helmet on, hold on to the belts.
Yeah, hang on to the belts and nothing's going to hurt you. You may roll around a lot.
You'll learn some new curse words, but you'll be all right. You know, and speaking of crazy and insane, the nitro coupes. I want to talk about that a little bit because I remember seeing those things run and just thinking, this is the most insane thing I've ever seen, a nitro door car. You know, from a spectator fan point of view, it was nuts. What's it like from a driver knowing that you have a fuel motor sitting, you know, inches away from your feet and legs?
Well, I best describe it as when you start out like I did and then progressively go to faster cars and faster cars and faster cars, it's just a little more progression. Everything's a little step up, a little step up. So it never struck me as wow. You know, there was never a wow factor. There was a, man, this thing's hard to handle factor. But one of the best stories I could give about that, like you say, when you strap yourself in, my first time at Sonny Leonard's, watching him dyno, well, my motors, the engine's sitting in there on its cradle, and you're watching through bulletproof glass through the room. And the first time he hits the throttle, everybody in the room jumps if they haven't been there before. And then he starts laughing. And I'm saying, what's so funny, Sonny? He said, you drivers are all the same. He says, I got concrete blocks, cinder blocks. I got bulletproof gas. I hit the throttle and you all jump a foot. He says, then you put the thing in your car. You put a piece of 32,000 aluminum between it and you, and you try and shove your foot down the carburetor. And I never looked at it that way.
That's very, very true and very funny.
And that's all there is, a 32,000 piece of aluminum between you and that motor.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of very, you know, you say progression and, you know, another word to throw there is there's a lot of aggression rotating around along with a lot of hot liquids and other things, you know, being thrown around in there.
Oh, yeah. There's so many things that, you know, a person always says when they have an accident, everything went so slow. And I said, well, I can explain that real easy to you. I said, you're having the accident. You know you're having an accident. Adrenaline comes in. Adrenaline says to your brain, hey, we're going to crash, and it's going to be fast. So your brain has to outthink the speed of the car. Your brain has to start saving you. So that's why it seems like things slow down. That's because you're thinking so fast. And it's amazing in a car that's running the big numbers when things go wrong, the actual things you see. I mean, I've had a drive shaft come out one time. So it busts through into the interior of the car, and I'm, you know, coasting now, but I'm coasting 180 mile an hour, and I'm watching this thing get closer and closer and closer to me as it's whipping around. I'm leaning over farther and farther and farther. And it's just you slowly, you do what you can to keep from getting hurt. I remember one time I ran off a track with the 200-mile-an-hour car before it was a 200-mile-an-hour car, and it went from the world's biggest wing. It had the world's smallest wing because I said, I'm going to build this pro stock car. I'm going to build it light, and I'm the best driver on earth, so I don't need the wing that these guys. I can handle it. Well, it got loose on the big end, and I'm going down the side of the track, and they had a monster truck show off the edge of the track the night before. So there was debris and crap, and this radio antenna comes through my floor like a snake, and it's working its way up toward my face, and I'm watching it. And then I look up, and there's this lady with this baby frozen on the guardrail, scared to death because I'm going straight at her. And I'm saying to her, and this is all happening in milliseconds, and I'm saying to her, lady, trust me, I'm not going to hit you and your kid. I'll crash this whole car before I do that. And I ended up smacking the rail and knocking the front tire and stuff off. But your brain thinks so fast and things slow down so much, it's unbelievable.
Oh, I could only imagine going at those speeds. And, you know, that's, you know, you talk to a lot of the pro mod guys or a few of the radial tire guys that have ran it out the back door. And they always say, you know, that the first eighth mile is fun. The second eighth mile gets kind of scary because the car starts making weird noises and you just hope nothing happens.
Well, I've always had a theory. Nothing good happens in the second eighth. Only bad.
Oh, totally. You know, you're at that point, you're, you know, you're at terminal velocity, and if anything happens there, you're pretty much, you become a passenger, whether it's an air ride or a land ride. If something happens,
right,
you're just, you know, you're kind of there.
Well, cars got so quick, and in my last years in Nitro Coupe, you know, in the Super Chevy stuff, that's what the Nitro Coupe stuff, nobody talked about eighth mile times. They didn't announce them. Nobody knew them. But, man, I could pump off a 360 back then. But nobody said anything about it. And that was back in 2000.
Wow.
So that's what people don't realize. They just don't realize. They don't realize that a Nitro Coupe goes from 0 to 100 mile an hour in 1 second flat. Now, they're doing that today also, these guys, especially the turbo deals. But here's what people don't realize about the turbo car. The turbo car has such a gentle hit because it has to build its boost, and then it just snowballs as it goes down the track and gets faster and faster. And I think the turbos are the future of the high mile an hour and low ETs, to be honest with you. And they finally now, the reason I never ran a torque converter, back when I ran, nobody made one that could hold the power. Well, now Chance is making them to hold any damn thing you want to put at it.
I'm still hung up on the fact that you guys were going 360s in those Nitro Coupe cars back then. And what do you think those cars would be able to do now if you had some of the technology you had now? If the NHRA even let them on the track.
I'll tell you, if I had the money, a lot of times in racing, you find big-time progressions by accident. So I went to whatever the organization was, Unlimited Deal, somewhere in Rockingham. And my car was getting so radical that, one, first I had to go from the manual shifters in the three-speed. A four-speed Lenko's got 27 clutches. When you go to a three-speed, that's one less case, so you got 18 clutches. So to make those clutches not burn themselves up, you got to have much higher clutch pressure in the transmission, which meant, like the four-speed, the handle pressure pulling it back could be anywhere from 18 to 20 pounds, spring scale on the handle for it to click on back. Well, when you go to the pressure you needed for the three-speed, now it's 40 pounds. And I was finding that 40 pounds, me yanking physically yanking a 40-pound handle in the car, was upsetting the car a little bit. You know, you got to have the exact same amount of weight on both back tires for the car to go straight. Because when one tire gets more weight on it than the other, it has more traction and it tries to drive around the other one. Well, then finally I realized, man, this is upsetting the car. So I ended up going to AirPods where I'm pushing the buttons. And then as that progressed, the AirPods, I said to myself, man, I'm still a little bit upsetting this car. MSD came out with a deal where it would shift automatically. It would push the AirPod solenoids for you. So I put one of those things in the car. MSD said it was going to work perfect, blah, blah, blah. And I'm at this race. And first qualifier, I take off. And I'm waiting, and the car don't shift in a second. So I just clutch it. And it's eighth-mile race, so I coast through about a four flat. I go back in the pit, I test it, it works fine. I just couldn't understand why it didn't work. So then on the second qualifier, I go up there and it does the exact same thing. It takes off, doesn't shift, so I clutch it. Well, anyhow, so I don't qualify, so I come all the way home to Missouri from Rockingham, and I had not taken a computer reading on the runs. I had not downloaded the computer because it was an aborted run. What am I going to see? Over the winter, I got to thinking, and this is what I mean by some things come by accident. I got to thinking, I wonder if that last run is still in that computer. And I went, and it was, I downloaded it, and what had happened was the reason the car didn't shift in the high is because the car left the starting line at high. And then I looked at the numbers. My God, I left in high gear with this nitro motor, and it still run a 950, 60 foot, just like it did normally, and on down the line. And then I realized, holy crap, I don't need a transmission. I've got enough power. I do not need a transmission. So way back then, I thought, boy, if I could just use no transmission and a torque converter to leave, but nobody made a torque converter that could do it. Now, that's what they got. And a lot of guys, if you listen to the cars, you're going to hear a few cars go really fast, and you will not hear a shift. They're leaving in one gear and going.
And then, you know, on the other side of that, you got the people that use like those 8-speed transmissions, even in the eighth mile stuff. And it, you know, it's crazy to hear those things bang down the track and the technology that they figured out how to, they discovered something there and how to make it work. And, you know, the tunability with it's kind of off the charts.
Well, the thing about the mini speeded transmission is almost like Top Fuel. If you see a Top Fueler go down the track, the engine's at one pitch all the way down the track. It doesn't rise. It just goes down the track. But what those guys do is they get on the dyno, they find the high power level of their engine, they realize what RPM that is, so they put in gears, multiple gears, just to keep the engine up there in that high power level. Yep. So that's how they're doing it.
And you know,
but the nitro deal's a different deal. Like the old saying is, nitro will turn a crank no matter what. And with the nitro, you could put any damn gear in there, and it'll push you down the racetrack.
Oh, the funniest thing is you spend a lot of time, you know, growing up around drag racing like I did, and then I'll never forget the first time I got to shoot nitro cars trackside. Was at Norwalk a couple years ago. And I was, you know, I've been around these my whole life. What's it, you know, it can't be that bad. There's a huge difference between being in the stands or maybe being around a car when it whaps the throttle and being a couple feet away from it when it comes by and the power that thing puts out. It's unworldly.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing how if you're standing next to a Top Fueler on the starting line, which I've got fortunate enough to get to do many, many times in my life, you think you feel the ground shake. You're really feeling the percussion from the engine, but it's incredible. People that never go to a drag race in their life and you their first experience is standing up close to a Top Fueler leaving the line, they can't comprehend what they just experienced.
No, it's complete sensory over, like all of your senses are completely overwhelmed just from every aspect of that car, between the fuel burn in your eyes, the loudness, and then, you know, the concussion of it going down the track. You don't know what to do.
And that's why television can never do drag racing justice.
Oh no, I always tell people, I'm like, it's something, it doesn't even matter if it's a bracket race. It's something you have to experience just to physically feel and see everything, let alone
right.
If you just get behind, you know, friends that don't really drag race or, you know, autocross, I'm like, go just do it one time. Even if it's in a semi-quick car, it's a different experience when you're going that quick, feeling that push you back in the seat for that long. It's very hard to describe. You know, if you try to explain it, people don't understand, except the fact that it's highly addicting is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I'd have to say it is. It's a great sport if, one, you got enough talent to stay alive, and two, you can afford it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I have the most expensive hobbies on earth between cars, guns, and cameras. It's just unreal on what all of those things cost if you want quality, for sure.
Sure, yeah.
Now, Bill, our time here is coming to an end. I appreciate you coming on the show. You know, I always like to give my guests the opportunity to kind of let everybody know where they can be found out, what's going on. So, you know, are you going to be on the track anytime soon? You know, where can people catch up with what you're doing?
Well, no, I retired in 2007. I live at a place called Mark Twain Lake. It's a small lake. It's 26-27 miles from one end to the other, but I'm proud to say I'm the only house on the lake. I'm on about 65 acres here. I love it. I've got a house in the woods overlooking a couple miles of water. I've got a boat storage that I've built because I'm right across the street from a marina and a campground. So I'm basically out here in the woods enjoying life every single day. I just thank God I'm healthy. It's a great day no matter what it's doing. I fabricate a lot for people. I haven't forgot how to do any of this stuff. It's just when you move away from the location I lived, I've been up here 14 years, and you're not on the TV constantly. You know, I was the most televised guy in drag racing in the 2000 era. Summit tracked that stuff, audience impressions, they call it. To not being there at all, people think, well, you don't know anything about the sport. You're out of it. I could be back in it if I wanted to spend my money. I could be back in it tomorrow and be competitive. But as Jeff Brozovich once said, I'm over it. 45 years of doing it, I'm over it. I've had a good life. I'm glad to talk to people about it, but I don't watch drag racing on TV, and I don't read the books and stuff. I'm just content working every day. When the sun comes up, the sun goes down. I find something to do.
Well, that's, you know, it's awesome that you found your place and are able to do that now, but you definitely made a huge divot in the world of drag racing, and for that we most certainly thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Anybody wants to catch up with me, I'm on Facebook, and my son has that Bill Coleman Drag Racing Life, which the only reason I'm saying check that out, everything you see on there, every car, it shows every car we've ever had. It shows us building them. This thing is homemade. We made our own molds for the bodies. We did everything, and everything was a first-time learning experience. So there's a lot of neat nostalgia on there.
Yeah, I encourage everybody, all of our listeners, please check out that page. I've been following it for a while. It's got some really, really cool stuff. And it's definitely a daily time capsule into the history of drag racing for sure.
Yep. I'm glad he does that for me. The neat thing about Barry doing that, Barry has all the records, all the runs. He started logging all that stuff when he was a kid on the crew. And I'm glad he did because I didn't. I was too busy racing. So whenever I need to know a little bit about facts of my history, I have to contact him.
Well, Bill, again, thank you for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again in the future.
All right. Send me a note when you're going to run the podcast so I can check it out.
Absolutely, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks for Bill for coming on and letting us in behind what went on back in the early days of Pro Mod Racing. So, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. See you next week, folks.